Good morning. Welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Tuesday, April 7th, and this is our Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition, packed as always. I'm Maya.
And I'm Alex. And Maya, good morning to you too. Feels like every single headline is interconnected now, orbiting each other like unstable satellites poised for a collision.
A bit dramatic even for you, Alex. But you're not wrong. We're starting with geopolitical risk. Because energy markets are reacting to shifts we haven't fully priced in, are we looking at a new commodity supercycle or just noise?
Noise is rarely just noise. It's often the signal of something much bigger. Then we dive into the AI disruption. Think economic repricing, but not the kind everyone's talking about. We're looking at how AI is fundamentally changing the calculus of value creation, which leads us to
the new digital battlefield. Cyber warfare, economic crime, the sheer scale of stolen assets is astonishing. Did you know over $36 billion was lost to crypto scams last year alone? It's a frightening number.
It is, and it's only accelerating. We'll unpack that and how nation-states are turning these tactics into foreign policy. Ready to jump in?
Stepping back, let's get to it. Allison Nathan and Samantha Dart reported a 50 to 70% price increase in natural gas since the Iran conflict began. Let's unpack that geopolitical risk in energy markets. Why should our audience focused on macro AI and blockchain care about a pipeline?
It's not simply about a pipeline, Maya. The immediate impact is quantifiable, that price surge, but the more significant risk is systemic. The disruption in Qatar, accounting for 20% of global LNG supply, creates a uniquely tight market, especially as we approach the critical inventory rebuilding season from April to October. It's a seven-month deadline, essentially, and that fundamentally alters how geopolitical shocks propagate through energy prices.
A seven-month deadline to avoid a 2022-style energy crisis. That feels remarkably unscientific.
It's driven by the predictable seasonality of demand. Natural gas isn't traded like crude oil, where strategic reserves offer more flexibility. Storage is paramount. That constraint allows for disproportionate price reactions to supply disruptions, even if the underlying demand hasn't materially changed. The fact that prices haven't skyrocketed further is in itself a warning sign.
Warning sign how? Everyone's panicking about oil, but natural gas is quietly facing an existential crisis.
Demand destruction has been lower than anticipated, particularly in Asia. And China's mild winter is temporarily alleviating pressure, offloading LNG cargoes into the European market. But that's a short-term fix. The US is already at maximum LNG export capacity, meaning there's limited ability to compensate for Qatar's shortfall.
So China is basically playing energy benefactor right now, and that's not sustainable.
It's a temporary masking of the severity of the problem. That inventory release isn't addressing the root cause, which is the 3 to 5 year timeline for Qatar to restore full liquefaction train capacity. Samantha Dart emphasized this duration. It's not simply a rebuild, it's a systemic vulnerability.
Liquefaction trains. Are we talking about tiny model railways for gas?
Not exactly. Liquefaction trains are massive industrial facilities. Rebuilding them isn't a matter of weeks, it requires complete reconstruction. This means the Qatari disruption won't be resolved quickly, even if production restarts. The market is currently mispricing this long-term impact, anticipating a faster recovery.
David Gura mentioned President Trump's ultimatum to Iran. Is the market factoring in the potential for a Strait of Hormuz closure?
Limited thus far, surprisingly. Paul Dobson observed this resilience, noting it hadn't anticipated 5 weeks ago. Strategic reserves and alternative routes are mitigating the immediate impact.
But this is changing.
The risk isn't complete closure, as the sources repeatedly note, but selective control, essentially a toll booth system.
A toll booth? So Iran's plan isn't to block shipping, it's to extort money from everyone.
That's the critical shift in regional security priorities, as Alyssa Ewers points out. The Gulf states want to prevent Iran from establishing a precedent of controlling access to international waterways. It's not just about reopening the strait, it's about preventing future control.
And what's the risk if Iran succeeds in establishing that control?
It fundamentally alters the cost structure of global trade. It introduces a persistent geopolitical risk premium into energy prices, increasing inflation and potentially destabilizing economies. It also incentivizes further investment in alternative energy sources, which could accelerate the energy transition.
Speaking of alternatives, what about Europe? They're still reeling from 2022, right?
Highly vulnerable. Samantha Dart explicitly stated they're at risk of a repeat crisis. The seasonality factor again, the need to rebuild inventories, amplifies the threat. And the dependence on natural gas, particularly for heating and power generation, remains significant.
So Europe is basically holding its breath and hoping China continues to offload gas.
It's more complex than that, but that's the gist of it. And that's where the macro picture comes in. The U.S. Treasury market debate between growth shocks versus inflation is further complicated by Trump's erratic messaging. If he seeks a compromise to reopen the strait, the oil shock reverses. That creates immense uncertainty.
Erratic messaging, that's putting it mildly.
Lissa Ewers frames it as a deliberate strategy to manage domestic political pressures. He's throwing spaghetti against the wall to see what sticks effectively. But that unpredictability makes it extremely difficult to model potential outcomes.
Let's talk about the oil side. What's the U.S. doing to mitigate the risk?
Operating at maximum LNG export capacity, as we discussed, limiting its ability to compensate for the Qatari shortfall. But beyond that, the U.S. strategy emphasizes attriting Iranian military capabilities through airstrikes. The skepticism, as Ryan Evans points out, is regarding the regime's rationality.
Attrition. Sounds optimistic.
It's based on the assumption that Iran will negotiate under sufficient pressure. However, their ingenuity maintaining F-14s for 4 decades despite sanctions should not be underestimated. They've demonstrated a remarkable ability to project power.
F-14s? Seriously? They're still flying those?
Yes, and they've managed to keep them operational without supply chain access. It's a testament to their indigenous engineering capabilities. That resilience explains why the engagement has been unexpectedly protracted.
The U.S. is attempting to bomb them into submission with planes that are older than some of the people involved in the negotiations.
A simplification, but the point stands. In the mine countermeasures gap is critical. The U.S. possesses fewer assets than NATO collectively, necessitating increased investment and innovative solutions.
Okay, so the U.S. can't produce enough gas, the airstrikes may not work, and they don't have enough minesweepers. This is sounding less like a strategy and more like a wish list.
It's a complex situation. The recovery of downed airmen is a high priority with established procedures. But even successful military operations don't guarantee a resolution. Contingency planning has been extensive, but real-world execution demands adaptability.
Adaptability, eh? What are the potential price scenarios if things go sideways?
Samantha Dart outlines a range from stabilization 20% below current levels, a best-case outcome, to 50 to 100% price increase in a worst-case scenario. The duration of the Qatar disruption is the most critical factor. A prolonged outage would significantly increase the probability of the latter.
And what about the geopolitical chess match? China specifically.
Well positioned to navigate the crisis, as multiple sources note, with substantial reserves and diversified energy sources. They're currently masking the severity of the supply shock by offloading inventories, but that's temporary. Their overall role is stabilizing, but not a long-term solution.
China's effectively kicking the can down the road for everyone else.
A pragmatic assessment. And the Gulf state's primary goal isn't just reopening the strait, but preventing Iran from establishing a precedent. It's about regional security, not just oil flows.
Let's bring it home. This feels like a waiting game. What's the most likely outcome in the next few months?
Based on the current trajectory and assuming no major escalation, I anticipate the situation will de-escalate by the end of April, with oil prices stabilizing at elevated levels, somewhere in the $80-$95 range. Negotiations involving 40 nations, Iran, Oman, and European and Chinese officials are the key.
All right, here's my bet. Oil prices will be above $95 by June 7th. Not a huge swing, but enough to indicate this isn't just a temporary blip. And I'm blaming the liquefaction trains.
I'll take the under. I predict oil will be below $90 by July 7th, driven by a combination of increased Iranian exports and a softening global demand picture. But honestly, the most surprising outcome in this entire scenario would be a predictable one. It's a uniquely chaotic situation.
Agreed. The interconnectedness of energy markets, geopolitics, and global economics is creating a perfect storm, and that volatility ironically creates some fascinating opportunities, and the fundamental tension here, the push-pull between physical supply, political risk, and market sentiment, is a perfect setup for AI-driven disruption in risk assessment and potentially blockchain-based supply chain solutions. 80% of venture funding in Q1 2026 went to AI companies. Let that sink in. It's not an industry anymore, it's a gravitational pull. We're talking about AI-driven disruption and economic repricing today, and that number feels like ground zero.
So here's the picture. It's beyond a sector boom. It's a fundamental reallocation of capital. The historical precedent for that kind of concentration is limited, frankly. It's not just about investing in AI, it's about the belief that AI is the investment, that future value creation will overwhelmingly flow through this space.
Future value creation. That's a politely worded way of saying that everything else is potentially a bad bet, isn't it? We're past peak disruption and into full-blown repricing.
Consider this, traditional economic models are actively being challenged. Jordi Visser talks about trillions of dollars of potential value, but importantly, he acknowledges the reliability of those valuation methods are becoming less certain. It's a situation where first principles thinking is paramount.
So the discounted cash flow analysis is officially dead. Because that's what it sounds like.
It's less useful. The pace of change invalidates long-term projections. The flywheel effect, as Visser describes it, is accelerating. Experience with agentic AI is fundamentally different than simply using chatbots. That makes predicting revenue streams nearly impossible.
It's like trying to forecast the weather on a different planet. Speaking of agentic AI, Anthropic's Claude Code with its Kairos agent seems to be a signal flare.
It is. The shift from reactive assistants to proactive persistent agents is the key. That's where the compute demand explosion comes in. Daniel Jeffries observing the agent economy mirroring human salary costs is critical. This isn't going to be cheap.
Holding it wrong is a spectacularly unhelpful user experience.
It perfectly encapsulates the shift in pricing. The subsidy era is over, as Alex Volkov frames it. Anthropic is signaling that users are going to pay the true cost of computation, and that cost is high. The problem is we're still in the early stages of understanding the scale of that cost.
Microsoft investing heavily in Copilot, but with only 3% adoption. That's a multi-billion dollar bet with limited returns.
It highlights a distribution challenge. Building the models is one thing, getting them into the hands of users and driving consistent engagement is another entirely. Copilot's low adoption speaks to the need for better product integration and demonstrable value.
But also, maybe people just don't want it. We're getting into the solution looking for a problem territory.
That's a valid point. OpenAI's acquisition of TBPN is telling, though. It's less about direct marketing and more about acquiring media juju to manage public perception. Fiji Simo understands that winning over the broader public is the next battle.
So they're hiring a public relations firm to convince us AI won't steal our jobs. Got it.
It's more nuanced than that. It's about expanding the conversation beyond the tech bubble. But the internal trade-off at OpenAI, with Simo prioritizing AGI deployment at the expense of leadership sustainability, is a warning sign. Rapid development isn't always sustainable.
The executive reshuffle, so everyone's too busy trying to build Skynet to remember to eat and sleep.
Essentially, Sam Altman wanting an IPO ahead of Anthropic, despite CFO objections, reinforces the competitive pressure. Being first to market, even if unprepared, is seen as a critical advantage.
The race for AI dominance sounds exhausting. And expensive. Speaking of expensive, China ordering substantial Huawei chips for DeepSeek development.
That's a geopolitical signal. It's a clear investment in AI infrastructure, independent of Western supply chains. The fact that they're prioritizing domestic chip production demonstrates a long-term commitment to self-sufficiency.
Is this where we start talking about AI arms race?
It's unavoidable. Visser frames AI as a nuclear weapon, and that's not hyperbole. Governments worldwide will relentlessly fund AI development for military dominance, potentially leading to government control.
Lovely. Just what we needed. What about the physical infrastructure? The data centers.
That's where the Iran situation becomes critical. The attacks on data centers and anticipated electrical infrastructure delays, affecting over 50% of U.S. projects, are a previously unacknowledged constraint.
So geopolitical instability is literally slowing down AI development.
The pattern is clear. AI development is now directly entangled with geopolitical risk. The demand for compute is infinite, as Visser states, and that demand requires a stable infrastructure, which is increasingly threatened.
We're bottlenecked by electricity and silver. That feels absurdly low-tech for a technological revolution.
The DRAM price is going up 400 to 500% since September highlights the supply chain issues. The current boom isn't just about software, it's about the commodities supporting compute. Silver, in particular, is becoming essential.
So hoard silver instead of Bitcoin.
Visser would argue yes. He frames silver as a rare earth resource given its usage in semiconductors. NVIDIA's internal projections of reaching $1 trillion in revenue also underscore the importance of hardware.
Let's talk about valuations. OpenAI at $852 billion, Anthropic at $600 billion, Ken Smythe reporting difficulty selling stock in secondary markets for OpenAI.
That discrepancy isn't just about valuation gaps. It's a reflection of differing investor risk assessments. Augment Capital believes Anthropic offers a better risk-reward profile. OpenAI's near-term returns are being questioned.
So people are willing to pay more for the promise of Anthropic than the reality of OpenAI. That's fascinating.
It speaks to execution capabilities. Anthropic's Claude Code previews a more ambitious vision, while OpenAI may be perceived as being more focused on immediate deployment.
And now a brief interruption for jargon translation, dry powder in private equity means.
It means a lot of investors have money they want to spend, but aren't finding enough good deals. Record levels of dry powder suggest an imbalance between available capital and deal flow.
Okay, so everyone's sitting on a pile of cash waiting for something to buy. Let's shift to M&A. AI responsible for 50% of M&A dollars.
It's fundamentally reshaping the entire process. AI tools are used throughout the lifecycle, from sourcing to integration. Mega deals are disproportionately driving the increase in volume.
So it's not a broad wave of acquisitions, but a few very large ones.
There's a signal here. Dealmakers are increasingly focused on transformative acquisitions. The potential for IPOs of OpenAI, Anthropic, and xAI could dramatically upend the market, driving proceeds to historic levels.
Assuming they ever actually IPO. And speaking of government involvement, Visser mentioned that as a risk.
That's a significant concern. Government control of AI technology could lead to multiple compression for private companies. The potential for regulation and nationalization is real.
That's a cheery thought. This whole thing feels like a garden being aggressively fertilized, with some plants growing at warp speed while others wither and die.
That's a remarkably apt analogy. AI-driven disruption and economic repricing is akin to a highly selective cultivation process, a few resilient species thriving in a rapidly changing environment, while others struggle to adapt.
It's terrifyingly efficient. Okay, Alex, distillation time. What's the core takeaway?
AI-driven disruption and economic repricing is fundamentally reshaping the global economy, driving a massive reallocation of capital towards foundational model companies, and creating a new landscape where traditional financial metrics are increasingly unreliable, necessitating a strategic focus on hardware, geopolitical risk, and the relentless pursuit of compute dominance.
And leaving the rest of us to wonder if we should learn to code or just start a silver mine. That's a good pivot, though. Because next up, the new digital battlefield, cyber warfare and economic crime. Half of large businesses experienced a ransomware attack last year. Isn't that just bad business practices? Like, shouldn't they already have their stuff secured?
That framing misses the point entirely. It's not simply a matter of individual preparedness, but a shift in the entire landscape. Ransomware has evolved from opportunistic crime into a sophisticated industry, a tool of economic warfare, and it's inextricably linked to the initial lack of security baked into the internet itself, alongside the rise of asymmetric encryption and, crucially, cryptocurrencies. It's become a market with its own bizarre brand of quality control, removing unreliable actors, as Peter Thalerson pointed out.
A market? Seriously? So hackers are like tech startups but evil?
Anya Shortland highlighted how ransomware groups are exhibiting behaviors we'd typically associate with legitimate businesses, reputation management, internal network issues, even a degree of specialization. That reframes them not as lone actors, but as organized entities operating under market discipline. It's chilling but essential to understanding the scale of the problem.
Okay, so it's organized. But aren't these groups just opportunistic? What's the actual incentive for nation-states to get involved?
The incentive is clear: economic disruption, intelligence gathering, and the erosion of trust in critical infrastructure. The Drift hack, as detailed by Laura Shin, is a prime example, a six-month intelligence operation likely linked to DPRK. Nation-state actors are deploying proxies, building trust with protocol contributors over years, demonstrating a level of sophistication far beyond code exploits.
Right, 6 months of networking to steal admin keys. It's like attending every industry conference pretending to be interested in the white paper just to get the login credentials.
An absurdly accurate analogy, actually. And it's tied to geopolitical realities. Ransomware groups often operate with implicit protection from governments, particularly in Russia, making direct response incredibly complex. That's what makes it economic warfare. It's not just about the money, it's about destabilizing adversaries.
Okay, so governments are enabling it. What about cyber insurance? I thought that was supposed to solve this problem.
That's where things get really twisted. Cyber insurance, intended to mitigate risk, has paradoxically incentivized ransom payments and lowered security standards. Insurers prioritize growth over security rigor, leading to inflated demands, as Shortland notes. It's a hidden complexity where well-intentioned governance mechanisms amplify the problem they seek to solve. Plus, trusting ransomware groups after payment is inherently risky. There's no guarantee of data recovery.
So pay the ransom and hope for the best.
Essentially. And that hope is increasingly reliant on AI, which is accelerating the ransomware landscape on both sides. It's improving attack capabilities, vulnerability scanning, phishing, but also defensive measures. However, AI also lowers the barrier to entry for attacks, making them more accessible and efficient.
The technology meant to fix it also makes it worse. Classic. Looking ahead, where is this going? Are we just doomed to a perpetual state of digital extortion?
Not necessarily, but addressing ransomware effectively requires a broader discussion of security trade-offs, especially concerning critical infrastructure. Shortland predicts a rising likelihood of attacks on essential systems, citing potential Iranian activists deploying weapons-grade malware. We're entering a period where the vulnerability of critical infrastructure isn't theoretical. It's a tangible risk, demonstrated by the Colonial Pipeline in 2021 and the recent Kent water outage.
Iranian activists disrupting water supplies.
And that brings us to the need for national preparedness, policymaking, and a recognition that cybersecurity isn't purely a technical problem, it's a societal trade-off. The focus shouldn't be solely on individual cybersecurity hygiene, but on a national-level conversation about acceptable insecurity and the cost of resilience. We also need to watch the adoption of stablecoins closely. Chris Perkins predicts $127 trillion in equities tokenizing, creating a critical security challenge.
So more stuff to hack. Wonderful. One last thing, what does the rise of crypto even mean for all this?
It's foundational. Ransomware's explosion wouldn't have been possible without frictionless communication, asymmetric encryption, and untraceable payments via cryptocurrency. But it also creates choke points for intervention. Circle's ability to freeze USDC funds is limited, but stablecoins represent a valuable tool for government intervention when facing malicious actors. And we have to consider the potential for adversarial actions. Iran's use of USDT to pay a toll booth fee, as highlighted by the BITS plus BIPS report, suggests the US dollar itself could be used against us. The situation is far more complex than it appears.
So the US currency facilitating conflict? That's unsettling. I guess the key thing to watch is whether stablecoin issuers like Circle will proactively invest in security operations and build better relationships with law enforcement, or if we'll continue to see a widening window of opportunity for attackers. Looking back at everything, the energy market volatility, the AI gold rush, and the escalating cyber threats, it feels like we've been dissecting interconnected symptoms of a much deeper shift. It's not just about pipelines and algorithms, it's about a fundamental recalibration of risk, isn't it? We saw that $70 spike in natural gas tied to a localized conflict, but that feels almost artificial, doesn't it? Like a pressure test revealing just how fragile these systems are, despite what the standard models tell us.
The data tells a story. The predictive power of traditional economic frameworks is eroding. We're seeing capital aggressively flow towards foundational AI, evidenced by 80% of Q1 venture funding going that direction, valuing companies like OpenAI and Anthropic at astronomical levels. $36 billion lost to crypto scams feels almost minor in comparison. But that flow isn't organic. It's a strategic repositioning driven by the understanding that hardware and geopolitical stability are now the critical limiting factors. It's not about finding the next app, it's about securing the infrastructure to build the next app.
And that infrastructure is also the battlefield. Half of large businesses hit with ransomware last year, $36 billion stolen in crypto scams. These aren't opportunistic attacks anymore. It's organized economic warfare, with cryptocurrency enabling it at a scale we haven't seen before. The Colonial Pipeline attack wasn't an anomaly, and the recent Kent water outage, however localized, adds to a troubling pattern. The $600 billion valuation of Anthropic versus OpenAI highlights a key tension. Is the potential of responsible AI enough to offset the reality of current capabilities?
That's a crucial question. The speed of AI development accelerates both attack and defense, creating a perpetual arms race. But the true disruption isn't just technical, it's conceptual. Think of it as a fencing match. We're no longer dueling with linear strategies, but engaging in a multidimensional contest where the rules are constantly changing, and the parry you expect often becomes the thrust. The DRAM price surge 400 to 500% since September isn't just about supply and demand, it's about control of the very tools of computation.
So where does that leave us? You predicted oil stabilizing between $80 and $95, possibly dropping below $90 by July. Is that still the most likely scenario?
It is contingent on de-escalation. But the underlying tension, China's role, the effectiveness of US strategy, potential government intervention in AI, means accurate modeling is exceptionally difficult. The potential for attacks on critical infrastructure is increasing, likely from Iranian activists, and the question isn't if they'll succeed, but when. And the promise of $127 trillion in tokenized equities feels distant when weighed against the vulnerabilities we've uncovered. The instability isn't about oil prices, it's about the foundational trust that allows complex systems to function.
I'd agree. Perhaps the biggest takeaway is that proactively identifying and securing those foundations is far more critical than reactively assisting. It's no longer about playing energy benefactor, but about recognizing that these disparate crises are all facets of the same precarious reality.
Indeed.
And the fact that only 3% have adopted Microsoft Copilot suggests that the real transformation has barely begun. We're witnessing a significant acceleration of change, and the next month, your 7-month deadline will be pivotal.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow to continue dissecting the unfolding macro landscape.